I also read quite a bit. I went over there with Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It just felt right for a hopefully epic road trip, and I was not the only one thinking that. There was an informal exchange of books with fellow travelers in the hostels. But after finishing the iconic classic Thompson's wild tale of visiting Sin City in a severely altered state, everyone I tried to trade Fear and Loathing to was also reading it, or had just finished it. I found Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth in a hostel and devoured it. I picked up Stephen King's The Shining in a similar fashion and remember reading it one scary night when I arrived in a lonely grape-picking town in France by myself. I was out of money and had to split from Big Greg, and I was forced to sleep outside next to a creek with mist rising eerily off of it. At one point, I decided to cut ties to my battered copy of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I was in a train station in Amsterdam, or maybe it was Munich, and I balanced it on the handrest of an escalator and watched the paperback creep up to the station's higher level, like its author, tipping and wobbling, but never quite falling off. And so I welcome our guest, Cheryl Della Pietra, author of Gonzo Girl, a novel based on her time as a writer's assistant to, yes, Hunter S. Thompson. Cheryl has brought along two entirely appropriate beers, one from Thimble Islands Brewing in her hometown, another from Flying Dog down in Maryland. Cheryl, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
How was your ride up, or ride down, I should say?
Uneventful, so that's good.
Good. That's what we like for Metro North. Tell us about how you ended up working for Hunter S. Thompson.
Well, I was a recent college graduate. I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, and I went to New York City wanting to get into magazines. And that dream landed me directly in a bar where I started tending bar as I was trying to start my career. So one day I had a friend interning at Rolling Stone, and he called me up and he said, Hunter S. Thompson is looking for an assistant. Do you want to put your hat into the ring? And I said, sure. So I wrote him a letter that day. I faxed it to him. And this letter was pretty unconventional. I definitely made sure I mentioned that I was a bartender. Mm-hmm. He called me at 3:00 in the morning and said, I liked your letter. Can you get out here tomorrow?
And, oh, my gosh. And he's in Colorado.
He's in Colorado, right? Okay. Just outside of Aspen in a small town called Woody Creek. So sure enough, I woke up the next day and got an airplane. What ensued was a 3-day trial period, which is part of the book. And I guess I passed because I ended up staying almost 5 months after that.
Oh, wow. So for one that may not be familiar with the great Hunter S. Thompson, why don't you tell us about him?
I'd like to read a sentence from the book. This kind of sums it up. In the book, he's called Walker Reed. It says, Walker's literary niche, the blurring of the line between fiction and truth, coupled with scathing political discourse and an almost mythical ingestion of drugs, is his and his alone. And that kind of sums it up. He's the father of gonzo journalism. And I guess if I were to have to define that, it's that you sort of put this narrative structure onto real life events. And his real life events just happen to be extremely crazy. And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is the best example of gonzo journalism that is based on a real life event.
Yeah.
And also, I would say he's well known for his political writing, Campaign Trail 72 being the most notable, but also later on, Better Than Sex, about the Clinton campaign, and so many of his writing for Rolling Stone.
Followed a very unconventional writing schedule. I had to get him onto or in front of his typewriter, what, like 2 a.m?
That's right.
So?
That was my job. Okay. I was 22 years old. I wasn't, going to be an editor in the conventional sense. But my job was basically to corral him to the typewriter. Spoken rule or unspoken rule was hands on the typewriter by 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
So if that happened, usually good things happened and pages were produced. The sun would rise. I saw a lot of sunrises, and then we would all go to bed.
Sure.
So sort of a vampiric schedule.
Yeah. But even a productive night or early morning for him was like 2 pages or so. Huh?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of writing, but Yeah, it was usually just a couple of pages. And then we would celebrate sometimes by going out. He sort of had a shooting range set up behind his house. So we'd go out there and shoot guns, you know, as the sun was coming up. Those are actually some of my most favorite memories. So, yes, hands on the typewriter by two and fingers crossed.
Yeah, sure. Had you shot firearms prior to going out there?
No. I'd never seen a gun before. And my baptism with a gun was actually with probably the most powerful gun in the universe. It was a 44 Magnum. He set up these exploding targets, and I shot it. And, of course, there was this massive kickback. I hit the target, which was great, and exploded. So there was a lot of fire things going on. And then we weren't wearing ear protection. So I very much remember being partially deaf.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And saying to him, is my hearing going to come back? Is my hearing going to come back? Don't worry about it, sweetheart. So that was my baptism by fire, literally and figuratively. So.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, how big is or was his property out there?
I don't know the exact acreage, but it was a house where he lived and then a cabin next door where I lived with his assistant. And then he had the range. He had, you know, peacocks. And,
yeah.
So it was, you know, Owl Farm is what he called it. And there were lots of grounds and... beautiful place. It was like sort of he called it a crude log cabin, but it wasn't quite as crude as,
right,
you know, Lincoln or something. But
so what happens prior to 2 a.m.? What are you guys doing all day? How are you sort of working on getting him closer to the typewriter?
Well, in the book, the character Allie asks Claudia, his assistant, you know, what happens before 2 a.m.? And she says, anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't go out very much, so there was plenty to do there. He liked watching movies. He liked getting in his hot tub. He liked shooting guns. Obviously, there were the substances, the drinking, CNN. Sometimes people would come over. So sometimes we'd go for a drive in, you know, the big red car,
mm-hmm.
Go out to dinner. So there was, you know, all sorts of things that, you know, in retrospect, a lot of it was fun, but a lot of it was also procrastination.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Sort of the inevitable was always on the horizon where it was time to write. So
why was he so resistant to writing? Was it he had just kind of lost his muse at that point?
I don't know. I think all writers kind of avoid it until they absolutely have to do it.
Yeah.
But certainly the substances probably at that point were playing a part. And, you know, this book portrays a writer in what I would say is the twilight of his career. Arguably, Hunter S. Thompson's strongest years were in the 70s when he did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He did Campaign Trail. He did Hell's Angels. And he did that fabulous Kentucky Derby piece with where he meets Stedman, which I hope we talk about later.
We absolutely will. Yes.
So, you know, I think that he was on the backside of his career at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there in 1992.
Okay. So at what point did you say to yourself, hey, that this is a book, this is a novel? I mean, that was, what, 2092?
Yeah, 23 years ago, yeah. About the same time you were traipsing about Europe.
That's right. That's right.
So I a little bit backed into the idea of writing this as a novel. You know, I started with the idea of writing a novel first. I had written one before this that was not published, and I'm grateful for that now because it wasn't ready. And I just always knew that this would make a great story. So I started writing it while my son was in the back seat napping when he was two, and I knew that that it would be a good story.
Great, great. All right. Much, much, much more to talk about with Cheryl Della Pietra, author of Gonzo Girl. We'll be back in a few.
business news at 20 past the hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on 1460 WVOX.
From the Fox Business Network, another busy day on Wall Street. Stocks sharply higher after big gains in overseas markets, after comments from officials in Beijing and Tokyo about stabilization measures. The Dow up well over 100. Japan's Nikkei had its biggest one-day percentage gain in almost 7 years, up more than 7.5%. A probe at United Continental has led to the departure of CEO Jeff Smyzik and two other top executives. Federal officials have been looking into charges. The company tried to influence the ex-head of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey to get project grant money. A German court has ordered a halt to a pilot strike at Lufthansa that's caused the cancellation of 1,000 flights, affecting 140,000 travelers. And McDonald's says it will switch to cage-free eggs in North America over the next decade. It's the company's latest effort to reinvent itself into what it calls a modern progressive burger company. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Pat O'Neill.
Do you want to learn how to steal customer credit card information from major retailers so you can buy anything you want?
Well, we can't help you with that. But among the many IT problems we solve, Barracuda's award-winning firewalls prevent hackers from taking your valuable data to the bank. Reclaim your network, like 150,000 other businesses have. To learn more about protecting customer data and your reputation, visit Barracuda.com/firewalls.
This is WVOX at 1460 for Highfield, Purchase, and Silver Lake.
WVOX.
Good morning. Welcome back to Books and Beer. I am your host, Michael Malone, here with Gonzo Girl author Cheryl Della Pietra. We had a chance to sample the Thimble Island Brewing Company coffee stout, and Cheryl is actually the first guest that we've had that has brought both beers for our show. I think we've had a few that have brought one beer, but never one that's rounded out our complete beer necessity bill for the show. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. Thimble Island Brewing Company, you live in Branford, Connecticut.
Yes.
Okay. And that is where Thimble Island Brewing Company is located. Tell me about the Thimble Islands.
We actually know the people who run the Thimble Island Ferry, believe it or not. It's this collection of islands in the Sound, and beautiful houses on them. They're via a tourist boat. You can go to Outer Island, which is open to the public, and it's they're lovely.
Okay, let me tell you what the Thimble Islands guys said about their coffee stout. Now, first of all, it's made from whole coffee beans from Willoughby's?
Yeah, so that is a local coffee shop. And so this is the local brew.
I gotcha.
Yes, so Willoughby's is in Branford, Madison, and New Haven. Delicious coffee.
A Connecticut institution.
That's right.
Okay, here's what they say. With a classic dark color and subtle yet unmistakable aroma of coffee, this brew presents itself as a modern American craft brewed stout. However, it's surprisingly easy to drink and gives a nod to the traditional British stout with mellow hop presence. 6% alcohol. What'd you think of it?
It's delicious. And actually, I'm thinking right now that this is the world's most perfect beverage because it combines coffee and beer, which are, you know, two of my favorite things.
Yes. What more can you ask for?
Stouts are interesting. I mean, I don't have a huge beer IQ, but I've had Guinness Stout, and it always reminds me of a milkshake a little bit.
Yep.
I'm very comforting about drinking them, but you definitely taste the coffee there, the coffee note there right after you swallow it. There's that little bitter coffee note, which is nice.
Yep.
What did you think?
I thought it was a good morning beer. different from a Guinness. Guinness has that nice thick head. That this is a little smaller on the head, but a nice little bit of sweetness there, a little bit of molasses. Definitely the kind of malty, roasty notes that one would expect from a stout. But interesting what they said, how that they had put it out as a winter beer, which one certainly would associate with a dark beer, you know, a hearty beer such as this. But one that seemed to play well in the warmer weather. So something where their guests and their visitors wanted some coffee stout year round, so they were able to give it to them. But real nice choice, and just one that goes well 10:24 in the morning as well.
Yes, excellent. Just a multitasking with this one.
Absolutely. All right, we are going to get back to talk about Gonzo Girl here, Cheryl's novel about her time, based on her time as an assistant to the late, great Hunter S. Thompson. So why a novel? Why not a memoir? Why not a tell-all?
Well, first of all, I was 23 years removed from the experience. So there were issues of, you know, trying to remember. I feel very beholden if I would have written a memoir to, you know, the facts as such as they were. And you know, this wasn't a particularly linear experience. So I wanted to give myself the freedom to kind of loosen the reins and say what I wanted to say about the experience rather than be beholden to kind of, you know, just a series of events. And I do, you know, even though perhaps the world didn't fancy myself a novelist, I always did, and I wanted to write a novel. And I just knew that this was great material. Once I started writing it, it came rather easily.
Yeah. And what was the process of going from manuscript to publication? Was it difficult finding an agent, finding a publisher?
I actually did some cold calling on the agent front. And, you know, I'm not dim enough to think that there was interest in this book because of me. It was, you know, certainly the hook on it, that this was about Hunter S. Thompson, you know, helped garner some interest for it. So my agent is Gary Morris, David Black Agency, was wonderful and actually helped me shape the book a little bit more before selling it ultimately to Touchstone Books at Simon & Schuster.
Okay. You were so a 22-year-old kid from an Ivy League school. How much did you kind of toughen up? I mean, the way he's portrayed in the book, he's a bully. He's an angry, mean man, certainly with some sweet streaks running through him, but just a nasty boss, huh?
Well, I hope that the book portrays it in a little more of a complex way, because mm-hmm. he could be a total sweetheart, very charming, kind of southern gentleman about him. You know, he's from Louisville. The blurb on the back by Piper Kerman kind of says both angel and devil, and that really sums it up. So yes, every day you sort of just didn't know what was coming your way. It was very intense both ways. The fun was ridiculously fun, and the rages were, you know, very intense. And so it was just a lot of extremes in both directions.
Yeah. What was it like coming back to Connecticut after, 5 months out there?
Yes.
The guns and the explosives and the hard drinking and whatnot, and then suddenly you're back, like, in your parents' house.
Right.
I guess. Was there a bit of a reentry period?
There was. It was a little bit, not going to lie, it was a little bit of a letdown in some ways. I mean, after all of that intensity, everything a little bit paled in comparison for a while.
Yeah, sure.
But I did maintain a connection when I got back to Connecticut. I outlined a book for him for about a month. It took me called 99 Days, which was about his trial. He was accused of sexual assault. They searched his property. You can imagine what they found. And eventually the case was dismissed, but he really wanted to write a book, which ultimately was not written, you know, about personal freedoms and illegal search and seizure and that sort of thing. So I did do that for a month back in Connecticut. And then I went out to Seattle where, you know, I did discover very good beer. Mm-hmm. But that was sort of my cooling off period, was in Seattle. I waited tables and traveled a little bit and just kind of got my feet back under me.
Gotcha. The main character in your book is editing the Hunter alter ego and putting quite a bit of work into his manuscript and in some ways kind of putting her own spin on it. Which book did you work on while you were out there?
He was working on a novel. The title was Polo Is My Life, and that was also not published. And then the 92 campaign started, and what ended up coming out of there was a book called Better Than Sex, which was published, and it was all about the Clinton campaign. And it's a great book.
Okay. All right. We'll be back in a bit with Cheryl Della Pietro. If you have any questions, if you want to speak with Cheryl, by all means, give us a call. 914-636-0110. Mike Malone here on Books and Beer.
with world and national news. Here is the latest update from Fox News Radio on 1460 WVOX.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. A Baltimore City board approves a $6.4 million settlement with Freddie Gray's family. He died in police custody in April. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake.
We must weigh the potential financial costs of defending the lawsuit in court and the potential exposure to the citizens of Baltimore if we are unsuccessful in court.
Six officers face criminal charges. Rowan County, Kentucky clerk Kim Davis spending some time with family, now out of jail with contempt charges lifted.
Attorneys for Davis say she'll return to work Friday or Monday, where she may or may not defy a judge's order to not interfere with her deputy clerks issuing same-sex marriage licenses. Her attorney has said that Davis will not violate her conscience and that according to state law, marriage licenses issued without the clerk's signature are not valid.
Fox News Radio's Jeff Manasso. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Today's community programs are brought to you by Assaf & Siegel, one of the preeminent law firms in New York State. Based in Albany, the state capital, Assaf & Siegel now serves clients all across the Empire State and in New York City as well. Senior partner Michael Assaf is an acclaimed and well-known civil litigator with over 29 years of caring, compassionate experience, specializing in difficult and contentious high-net-worth matrimonial and family law disputes in every county of our state. Assaf & Siegel, his full-service firm, also specializes in real estate development, zoning, urban planning, bankruptcy law and personal injury and healthcare matters, plus estate litigation and entertainment law with an emphasis on First Amendment issues. The firm is Assaf & Siegel. Michael Assaf is the senior partner. 855-339-5992. 855-339-5992. The firm is Assaf & Siegel.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 after 8 in the morning, we invite you to listen to Wartburg Moment, where in 60 seconds you can hear what Wartburg Senior Care can offer. And Wartburg Senior Care offers a great deal. Wartburg Moment is simply a way to briefly tell you what a great difference a community of hope and of healing can make in one's life. Wartburg Moment will bring you information on compassionate senior care, independent living, and integrated senior care services. You will hear in these weekly moments all about Meadowview Assistant Living and, of course, spiritual care. You will learn that senior living at Wartburg in their beautiful landscape grounds is quite wonderful. You'll hear about Wartburg's great care offered at their award-winning nursing home and new rehabilitation center. So, listen every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 after 8 in the morning to Wartburg's Moment and hear what you really need to know about Wartburg Senior Care. It's 60 seconds well worth listening to.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather on 1460 WVOX.
How about the forecast for Westchester County and vicinity on your Wednesday? Mostly sunny, our highs right around 90 for tonight. Increasing clouds, some showers and thunderstorms likely overnight. Nighttime lows 71. Showers and thunderstorms are likely on Thursday, and possibly a steady rain, a steady heavy rain for Thursday night. Highs tomorrow 79, lows at night with the rain down to around 68 degrees. Daytime Friday, some early showers, then becoming mostly sunny, a high of 80. Saturday, partly sunny, 78, rain at night. I'm a meteorologist, Steve Pelletieri for 1460 WVOX.
Amplify your voice on the forum at 1460.
Hello, welcome back to Books and Beer. Mike Malone here with our guest, Cheryl Della Pietra, author of Gonzo Girl. Cheryl, where were you? What were you doing when you received word that you were going to be a published author?
Well, I was at work. I have been on the copy desk at Usk Weekly on and off as a freelancer since 2001, and that's where I got the call. It was great because I was just about to meet my husband for lunch, so we had a very nice lunch together.
Oh, that's great.
To celebrate.
What was the feeling?
I've been trying to do this for a really long time. It's very interesting to be called, a debut author at 45. So it's something I've been trying to do for a long time, and it was just, the feeling was fantastic.
Okay. All right. So I can't stop thinking about your time out there in Woody Creek. Hunter always had this coterie of famous people. Did you meet some interesting celebs out there?
I did. You know, I was only out there for 5 months, but I did. I met Ed Bradley. One of my favorite stories is I showed him how to boot up a Mac Classic, to turn on a Mac. And at a party, I met Gary Hart, which was also very interesting at that time. And, you know, he had not all of his friends were famous, but they were all rather accomplished in their own way. He was friends with lots of artists, local artists, Earl Biss, Paul Pascarella. And, you know, Johnny Depp came on the scene a little bit after I was there. He was out there, I think, more toward 1998 when the Fear and Loathing movie was being made.
Right.
So, yeah, always interesting people around.
There's a romantic spark between the main character and some A-list Hollywood type. Can you
even divulge? Even this beer is not going to get that.
Oh, darn it. Well, it was worth a shot. Not giving up any names here.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. So one wonders while reading it, how much of this is rooted in fact?
Well, if I were to put a number on it, I would say about 60% is true. You know, okay. I've sort of studiously avoided, you know, picking apart the whole book. But certain things definitely are true.
Yeah.
That scene where they, you know, shoot the gun and the cops pull them over, that all really happened. Where he was doing his artwork, that actually all was true at the time. Some of the financial issues that are portrayed in this book were also true. So, you know, I would say more than half of the book is true, and certainly the day-to-day is true.
Yeah. Was it a positive experience for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wouldn't trade it for a minute. You know, it's really a magnified version of what a lot of people experience right out of college, which is your first job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, starting to set your own boundaries. So this is really about the freshman year of life. It's just much more magnified than, am I going to get my boss coffee? It was, you know, am I going to, you know, go on a drug run or whatever. So I think there's sort of a universal, you know, feeling to it.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Did you stay in touch with Hunter after you departed?
Well, I did the outline for him. And then the last time I saw him was when he was reading from the Rum Diary in Union Square at the Barnes & Noble in New York City on Halloween. So you can imagine, first of all, what that scene was like.
Sure.
My husband, he was my boyfriend at the time, he said, we have to go down. And so I went there and I bought my book. I stood in line like everybody else.
Wearing a costume? Or
no, I was not wearing a costume. But I got to the front of the line and he looks up at me and he grabbed me and he pulled me across the desk and he started giving me a noogie. And
a brotherly.
Yes. And he said, stay over there. He goes, you're coming out with us. We went out that night to the Gramercy Tavern with, you know, a bunch of people. And Benicio del Toro was one of them, which I thought was cool. And so that was, I guess it was around 98 when the book came out.
Okay.
And that was the last time I saw him.
Okay. What was your reaction when you'd heard that he had died?
You know, deep sadness. It was, you know, when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, I think it was Entertainment Weekly said, the first line was, this one hurts. And that's kind of how it felt. You know, he was such a truth teller. I think he's really sorely missing in politics. His voice is sorely missing. I would just want two sentences on Trump. I just want two sentences on, you know, Obama, on Palin, just, you know, his take on politics was just so unique and so true. So I think that his voice is really missing. His spirit's really, really missing from our literary landscape and our political landscape.
Do you see his spirit in any authors today?
That's a good question. I would have to think about that a little bit. You know, what I think we're seeing is, you know, this idea of gonzo journalism was a focus on, you know, this immersive quality. And I think we see echoes of that now in social media, you know, this focus on the eye. There's a little bit of that. But, you know, he was a singular voice and no one's really doing what he did.
You want to do the speed round?
Let's do it.
All right. Best Hunter S. Thompson book?
Well, I could say Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but aside from that one, Campaign Trail 72.
Okay. Best thing about living in Connecticut?
Pizza.
Worst thing about living in Connecticut?
No pro hockey team.
book everyone loves that I just don't get.
50 Shades.
Oh, yeah? I don't know if everyone loves that.
Apparently, like, millions of people love it.
All right, we're going to get back to that. If I could have just one beer for the rest of my life, it would be...
Party beer, I'll say Corona. Serious beer, Pyramid Hefeweizen.
Pyramid Hefeweizen,
yeah,
okay.
That's my Seattle beer.
I gotcha, okay, good. So 50 Shades, did you read it or did you read them?
I started and I couldn't get past a few pages. And I know I don't like to trash other authors because I know how very hard
it is. No, that's totally
but
welcome.
But I think she can comfort herself by wrapping herself in the $95 million she made last year. So,
Just substandard writing? Is that the issue?
I guess... I think there's actually better erotica out there, and you know, I think, you know, that also kind of, you know, rankled me. Like, oh, you know, apparently there's an audience for this, but I think there's better material to yeah. fill that. But I guess, you know, I really didn't read too much of it, and I didn't see the movie, so I can't really say, but I didn't get into it.
Yeah. I mean, not to single her out, but I'm kind of two minds about those authors where... people are buying their books and they're reading their books. So on one hand, it's really good that a lot of people are immersing themselves in these books. Mm-hmm. But part of you just wishes they were immersing themselves in let's face it, better books.
Sure. Sure. But power to her. You know, she found the niche and went with it.
And it's neat how that grew so organically. I mean, that was... Mm-hmm. It was fan fiction.
That's
initially.
Right, it's Twilight
and
fan fiction.
It just took off because people... really liked her writing
right, found
and her
its
stories.
Audience. It absolutely found its audience.
Yeah.
It blew up.
All right. Speaking of popular books, you've got a nice blurb from Piper Kerman. Piper is the author of Orange is the New Black, hit show on Netflix.
Yes.
How do you know Piper?
Her husband and I were good friends in college. Her husband and I started a magazine up in Boston called POV, where my husband also worked. So we met Piper there, and we all lived in Boston together. We all moved back to New York together. And then at some point, you know, they took us out to dinner one day, and they said, we have some news. And we were thinking, you know, baby, what's going on? Marriage, what's going on? And they said, Piper's going to prison. And we were like, what? That's sort of the very last thing we expected to hear. And then we got the whole story. You know, she, we visited her up in Danbury when she was there a few times. What I really admire about Piper is how she parlayed this, you know, her high profile now into, you know, what's basically a career in prison activism. So I have a deep admiration for her work and her book, and just glad to see all the success.
Sure, sure. How was her mood when you visited her in prison?
Good. You know, I guess better than expected. And, you know, she was there for 12 months, and certainly there were people who were sentenced there longer. So you know, it felt like there was perhaps a light at the end of the tunnel.
Sure, sure.
That wasn't so far away, but it certainly was a huge adjustment. So we were happy to, you know, support her during that time.
Yeah. Here's what Kerman said in part about Gonzo Girl. An intense story, Della Pietra's tale about writing, firearms, psychotropics, and the pros and cons of hot tubs will suck you in and take you on a ride. Gonzo Girl is a ticket you want to buy. We'll be back in a few minutes talking with Cheryl Della Pietra on Books and Beer.
World and national news. Here is the latest update from Fox News Radio on 1460 WVOX.
Fox News Radio, I'm Pat O'Neill. A Baltimore City board has approved a settlement in the Freddie Gray case. The family of the man who died while in police custody gets $6.4 million. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake.
The city's decision to settle the civil claims related to Mr. Gray does not represent any judgment on the guilt or the innocence of the six police officers.
The settlement could play a role in whether a judge decides to move the trials for the officers out of the city. Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis, who refused to issue marriage licenses to gay couples, now out of jail.
Attorneys for Davis say she'll return to work Friday or Monday, where she may or may not defy a judge's order to not interfere with her deputy clerks issuing same-sex marriage licenses.
Fox Radio's Jeff Manasso. McDonald's says it will switch to cage-free eggs in North America over the next decade, its latest effort to become what it calls a modern and progressive burger company. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Fox News on your time. The Fox News iPad app is ready to go with all the great features from FoxNews.com and our iPhone app optimized specifically for your iPad. Watch the latest clips from your favorite Fox News shows. Personalize the app by creating your own newscast using the video playlist. Listen to Fox News Radio live. Get local weather forecasts. And it's all free. Go to FoxNews2Go.mobi. That's Fox News, the number 2, Go.mobi.
Some people would call him a loser. He ran for state office. He was beaten. He started a business. He failed. He ran for Congress. He lost. He was nominated for vice president. He lost again. But he knew only those who never tried are the real losers. And Abraham Lincoln was no loser. Persistence. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
This is an unsolicited testimonial, call it a commercial if you will, about a brilliant, dedicated young Mexican fellow. His name is Jesus Valencia, but he's one of the brightest, smartest, and hardest working tradesmen we've encountered. And especially what he does better than anyone we've found is roofing. He's like a Nureyev up there on the roof. He goes right to the problem and he fixes it permanently for a lot less than the big-time roofing companies charge you. Jesus Valencia is his name. He's the best we've found in years at doing this. His number in Westchester for all kinds of roofing matters is 914-576-5596. I tell you, only the guy is really good. So I represent young Mr. Valencia to you only as a roofer who's bright and will work hard to fix up your roof. 576-5596.
This is Dino Yotiris, president of the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in New Rochelle, and I would like to invite all of you, together with Father Nicholas Anktel, our priest, and our entire parish council, to attend the annual Greek festival being held on September 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th at the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church at 10 Mill Road in New Rochelle. We have live Greek music and dancing, plenty of Greek food and pastries, a flea market, a marketplace, rides for the kids, and we're raffling this year a lease of a 2015 BMW. Please join us at Holy Trinity Church.
Be sure to listen to WVOX Local News early mornings on Good Morning Westchester, brought to you exclusively by Trustco Bank. Trustco Bank, where you get free interest-bearing checking accounts, free debit cards, and completely free use of over 43,000 ATMs worldwide. Plus, pre-wards, which earns you cash back. Move your money to Trustco Bank.
Continuing our commitment to New Rochelle, 1460 WVOX.
WVOX.
Good morning, Michael Malone, your host of Books and Beer. Here with Gonzo Girl author Cheryl Della Pietra. We are sampling the Flying Dog Pale Ale, a 5.5% alcohol pale ale. We do try to stick with mostly regional greater New York brews. We did bend the rules for this one. Flying Dog, based out of Frederick, Maryland, and we had good reason to. It fits with our Hunter S. Thompson theme today. Cheryl, you want to tell us why Flying Dog was right for you to bring today?
Sure. The packaging is done by Ralph Steadman, who is Hunter's longtime illustrator. The Kentucky Derby piece that Hunter wrote for Scanlon's Monthly in 1970 was the first time he meets Steadman. It's such an amazing piece. Steadman famously illustrated Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and subsequent works. And his style, his artistic style, perfectly dovetailed with Hunter's. There's just something very explosive about it, sort of raucous. There's chaos. So he does the packaging for these beers, and there's actually a Gonzo Imperial Porter
that's right.
Supposed to be very good, and several others, but I'm enjoying this one.
Yeah, what'd you think? Good beer?
Excellent.
What do you like about it?
Well, I like citrus in my beer.
Okay.
I was sort of, you know, when I said the Pyramid Hefeweizen, I just remember putting a bunch of lemons in that. So this has a lot of citrus notes. That's what I'm getting out of this one. And a little bit kind of grassy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some grassy notes, definitely. That's how they describe it, actually. Grassy, citrus, two for two, well done. Hey, how about slight perfume hop aromas? Was that your next comment?
Well, I said to my husband, I said, I'm not going to leave the show without using the word hoppy. So I almost don't know what that means. It's
right.
kind of a weedy note, bitter note.
Okay, okay. Yeah, the hoppy beers will have kind of a grapefruity smell to them.
Okay.
And a real bitterness on the tongue that people either love or don't love that much. This is a pale ale, so it's a step down from the IPAs in terms of hoppiness. Kind of a good across the board beer, you know, since there's a bit of a love not love factor with the IPAs, but these are just a little more widely accessible for people. 5.5% alcohol, not overwhelming, but yeah, a nice tasty brew.
It's delicious. Yeah.
And it's got its roots in Aspen and in Woody Creek, in fact, if their website is to be believed. In 1990, they opened up a brew pub in Aspen. The brewmaster, who I think was an astrophysicist, lived in Woody Creek, as did Hunter, and then the place advanced to an actual brewery in Denver before relocating to Frederick, Maryland. So,
wow.
Yeah, a beer with very definite roots in the mountains of Colorado. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about your writing and your book here. Do you like a beer when you're writing, or do you kind of put it off till the end, or a glass of wine, or what?
I usually have a glass of wine, if anything. I have to concentrate. so not more than one, but, I tend to be more of a wine drinker when I write. I like whites, reds, rosés. So I just something to kind of, I think a lot of writers, they can get blocked or not quite relaxed or focused. And I think one glass of wine just takes the edge off, all of those voices where you can just focus and work.
Yeah.
And
you're a veteran mixologist as well. Yeah,
I am. I started bartending my senior year of college. And then when I went to New York, I worked at a blues bar down on Bleecker Street called Terra Blues, which was, we mixed a lot of awful drinks with blue Curacao. You know, we had to play off that blue name.
Okay.
So it was like Long Island iced teas with blue Curacao. So I can only imagine how much blue, vomit I was responsible for. But
I think I saw some of that walking to the red line.
Exactly. So I always loved attending bar, and it's a skill I've, always had in the back of my mind. Well, I can always do that.
Yep. You'll never go hungry
or
thirsty, I guess.
But I like the social aspects and that sort of thing. And then in Seattle, I did it for this place called Club Castle. That's with 2 K's before the Kardashians.
Okay.
But what I did not like about working at that place was that they had their liquor on a gun, on a dispenser. And to me, part of being a bartender is, your hand is in it.
Yeah.
I love tending bar, and it certainly served me well out in Colorado.
Yeah, your main character spent a good portion of the book mixing up drinks for Hunter and his compadres. What was his kind of go-to drink?
His baseline, like the all-day drink, was Chivas and water on ice. And then other things would sort of be thrown in there. So the Chivas and water on ice was kind of an all day thing. And then sometimes it would be a beer, sometimes a glass of wine, sometimes like green chartreuse or something really weird like that.
Wow.
We mixed a lot of margaritas. wild turkey sometimes. So he wasn't particularly discriminating, but the Chivas was his drink.
Yeah. Now, were you ever able to really see that he was clearly intoxicated? I mean, he kind of had this legendary tolerance.
Well, what's funny is that my first week there, his assistant said to me, you got to put more water in the Chivas and water. You actually got him hungover. And I actually wear that like a badge of honor.
Absolutely. Well done.
So
what are you working on now?
I mentioned my experience at Us Weekly. I'm working on something right now that's kind of immersed in that celebrity world, celebrity culture. I find it fascinating. I also find it fascinating sort of our, obsession with it. So I'm working on something a little bit in the satirical vein around that culture.
Work of fiction?
Yes. Okay. Yes, another novel.
All right. Do you have a publisher lined up, or is it too early in the game?
It's a little early in the game. Okay. So I'm just entering the woods.
Sure. So. Hey, what are you reading these days?
I'm reading, actually right now, a book called My Salinger Year by Joanna Rakoff. We are going to be on a panel together at the Baltimore Book Festival at the end of the month, and it's her year working answering J.D. Salinger's mail, which is kind of fitting that we would be put together. I just finished Movie Star by Hilary Lifton. Our books came out, our debut novels came out a week apart, and even though we've never met in person, I think we feel an affinity. We're virtual friends. So I just finished that book, which I enjoyed very much. So those are two things I'm just finished and I'm starting.
Okay. Now, the main character's novel that she works on in your novel, that never saw the light of day? That was just sort of to better your craft?
Yeah, it's more of a plot point in the book.
Okay.
So I had to kind of have that be a little bit more fully formed. I was not allowed to work on my own stuff out there. That was sort of made very clear that my role was to, work for Hunter, and I totally got that. In addition to the writing, like, he needed a lot of nurturing, to direct him to the typewriter and that sort of thing. And I did feel like I wasn't, encouraged to do anything but what I was doing out there in terms of supporting him in his writing.
Yeah.
That kind of is a plot point in the book.
What was kind of your scariest moment out there?
It's very difficult to describe how I never felt in actual danger, despite all the guns and the drugs and that sort of thing. But there was one argument we had, and he did throw a plate toward my head, and it went kind of whizzing by my ear, and it crashed onto the ground. And I kind of looked at him, and he looked at me, and I was like, really? Did that just happen? And so what's funny is he said, I did not just try to hurt you. And I said, I believe you. And I actually really do believe him. It was more for effect.
I got
But it was sort of that kind of an environment. A lot of things done very dramatically for effect.
Yeah, sure. Now, the main character's family back home in Connecticut, mm-hmm. portrayed as a loving family, but not the most progressive thinkers. Did your family, were they upset at all, or did you just say to them, hey, this is fiction and this is truly not you guys?
Oh, no, they love the book. They've been very, very supportive. They're very proud. This family is different from my real family.
Okay, so. I figured. All right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time. We could certainly go on for a couple more hours, but we're not allowed to. A huge thank you to Cheryl Della Pietra, author of Gonzo Girl. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Okay. And thanks for tuning into Books and Beer. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Ronnie Levine, author of the Tarrytown-based ice cream shop detective crime novel. Enjoy your books and enjoy your beer. Bye.